Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Rovner can't be here today, but she will listen to the tapes of the argument. So our first case, Aquin. Mr. Brooks.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Brooks. I represent Aquin Federal Bank and its successor, Aquin Loan Servicing. With me here today is David Chizawer, who represents Moss Cadillus. I'll be presenting argument on behalf of all parties, unless the Court has specific questions about Moss Cadillus, in which Mr. Chizawer is happy to answer questions if it pleases the Court. Your Honor, the Office of Thrift Supervision Regulation that is at issue today has two parts, a little like Gall in the Caesar memoir. The two parts are a preemption part and a savings clause. And the basic error that the district court committed was in skipping over the preemption clause and going straight to the savings clause.
Now look, many of their charges are breach of contract and fraud, which are accepted by subsection C. I think you should focus on the charges in this very long complaint that really involve the regulation of these mortgage servicing companies.
Well, Your Honor, I'm happy to do that. Let me first of all say, with respect to the statement that many of the charges are breach of contract, there's really one class action allegation about breach of contract.
No. They keep saying that you imposed fees that were not, contractually a contractual obligation, right? That's breach of contract.
Well, let me answer that in a couple of ways, Judge Posner, if it
pleases. Not a question, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, the first answer is there are many allegations and claims in the complaint that really have nothing to do with fraud or breach of contract.
That's my question, right?
Yes, Judge.
The ones that are breach of contract and fraud, I don't think you have a prayer. But there are others which are regulatory in character.
Yes, Judge, and let me point some of those out for the Court if that makes sense. An example, Judge, would be a plaintiff's claim under California Business and Professions Code 17200, that is California's unfair competition law. What the plaintiffs allege in paragraph 141 of the complaint is quite clearly a state statutory regulatory claim. What they say is California Civil Code 2954.4, which is a California statute, provides that a late charge may not be imposed on any installment within 10 days of its due date. I mean, that's the predicate, or one of the predicates anyway, for the California state law consumer protection claim. Very clearly a statutory claim, very clearly one that imposes substantive requirements on a regulated thrift. Another example, the 11th cause of action, which is a statutory cause of action under California's Rosenthal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. The plaintiffs contend in paragraph 156 A and B that state statute imposes limitations on representations about fees that are incurred and fees that may be added to the debts. Again, a state statutory claim that can't plausibly be characterized as a contract claim or a fraud claim. Yet another example, the 15th cause of action, claims under Pennsylvania's Consumer Protection Statute. Here the plaintiffs contend in paragraph 186 C.
I don't understand 156 A. Falsely, look at B.
Yes, Judge.
So page 29 of the complaint. Falsely representing and collecting charges as attorney's fees when no such attorney's fees were actually incurred. Why isn't that simply fraud?
Well, Your Honor, it might be fraud, and if one believed that fraud were saved, it could potentially be pursued as a fraud claim. But here's the issue. The Rosenthal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act has different remedies from a common law fraud claim. It has a different statute of limitations.
Like what different remedies?
Well, for example, statutory penalties without any proof of actual damages. Another thing is, of course, it has
Why does that or the statute of limitations make any difference?
Well, the best...
Presumably, a common law fraud comes with statutes of limitations and with punitive damages. So what difference does it make whether it's statutory or common law, provided really is fraud or breach of contract, and so it fits that paragraph C of the regulation?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's different. One is a statutory penalty is automatic. Punitive damages are not automatic, and I think can't constitute...
Why should that make a difference? I don't understand.
Well, the way that I think about it was the way that a district court in the Silvis versus E-Trade mortgage case described it, which is...
District court?
Your Honor, I don't argue it's binding on the court. I think it's an interesting analysis,
well,
though.
If it's interesting, just say what's interesting. You don't have to cite it, right?
The analysis, I guess, that I find persuasive is the analysis that a fundamental feature of any regulatory regime is the liability imposed for violating the regime?
Of course, and that's true of tort law, right? Whether it's common law.
I think that's probably
right.
So
state laws, I'm looking at C, state laws of the following type are not preempted, et cetera, to the extent they only incidentally affect the lending operations of federal saving associations. And it says contract law and real property and tort law, criminal law. It doesn't distinguish between common law and statutes.
That's true. It doesn't. What the OTS
says. Why should a statutory penalty be preempted, but not a common law, punitive damages doctrine?
Well, Your Honor, if it pleases the court, let me just tussle with you a little bit on the claim that common law claims are generically exempted from the preemption. What the OTS says.
Well, which common law claims are exempted then, in your view?
In my view, any common law claim that affects one of the enumerated categories in 12 CFR 560.2b would be preempted, and that's what the OTS says in their final rule.
That's not what it says. It says state laws of the following type are not preempted, as long as they just incidentally affect the SNLs. No, so I don't understand why that ties back to enumerated provisions of B. I don't get that.
With respect, Your Honor, what I said was that the final rule of the OTS says that it's not the codified 12 CFR provision, but a 61 Federal Register, the final rule announced by the OTS pursuant to notice and comment cited in our brief at page 7. What the OTS says is, in implementing this rule, we intend that the first question will be whether the conduct that is challenged falls into an enumerated category in 560.2b. If it does, the OTS says, that is the end of the matter. If it doesn't, then the court is to move on to 560.2c and ask itself whether it then falls into one of the exceptions and only incidentally affects regulated operations. Respectfully, though, we think it's clear from the OTS, which ought to be entitled to deference.
So tell me concretely what kind of fraud and breach of contract claims, in your view, survive preemption.
Well,
an example
of a contract breach that we don't think would be preempted would be a contract that expressly states a particular interest rate when the servicer, such as my client, charges a different interest rate. The contract says 8%, we charge 12%.
Of course, that's one of their charges, that you add on interest rates that are not provided in the contract.
They do have an allegation about increases in monthly payments. I don't think there's anything about changing interest rates, but there is something about increased payments. But I'll give you an example of what they characterize as a contract claim that we dispute.
No. All we need is... So you're conceding... Look, their complaint has to be read broadly, and so forth, the way we do. So surely there are many, and there are hundreds of charges... There are many that simply say you're doing something that's not permitted by the contract, adding fees, adding this, adding that are not authorized in the contract. They can't possibly be preempted. And similarly with the fraud claims.
Your Honor, here's our read of that, if it pleases the court. The complaint characterizes as contract claims things like allegations which say Ocwen charges late fees when the payments aren't late. And what you'll see in the complaint, which is really quite extensive, quite detailed in many ways, is you won't see an allegation which says Ocwen disagrees with the plaintiffs about what the late period is.
Your appeal is premature. District court will find out eventually. Discovery will disclose what exactly is the conduct that they're charging as breach of contract and fraud. They've mischaracterized it. It's not really breach of contract and fraud. Then you're okay.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think where we may disagree on that is in the interpretation of how the savings clause and the regulation works. Again,
I don't understand you. If it's a straight breach of contract or fraud, it's not preempted.
Respectfully, Your Honor, every case we've cited, two things. First of all, every case we've cited is, in fact, a Rule 12 case or a state court equivalent pleading stage dismissal case. So I guess the first issue I would have is we don't agree that discovery would illuminate these issues, particularly in a complaint this extensive. But the second part is courts have repeatedly, including federal courts, including even the Second Circuit, we think, in the Flag versus Yonkers case, have dismissed claims that were common law or state consumer protection claims on grounds very like this. And the basic analysis is this. Yes, it is true that federal thrifts can affirmatively opt into a contract regime in an express contract setting. What is not true, however, is that background principles of state contract law, for example, the duty of good faith and fair dealing or some other background principle, can fill in gaps to create obligations, and that's where we think this complaint is so different, Your Honor. There are allegations, for example, that we...
You're reading out of C contract doctrines like the duty of good faith and performance?
No, Your Honor, what we're saying is you don't get to see if the claim, common law or otherwise, affects a subsection B category. And, again, that's the OTS final rule where we urge judicial deference to that.
Get you. So give me an example of a fraud claim that, in your view, is not preempted.
That is not preempted? For example, an affirmative fraud in the inducement claim where the bank says, if you come in on such and such a day, we will offer you a loan on these terms, and then you come in that day and we offer you a loan on a different set of terms. That may well not be preempted because there is an affirmative act of conduct, affirmative promise that is relied upon by the other side. Here that's not alleged, and I have to urge that when one reads this complaint, one will see allegations that simply say things like, the fraud is that you posted a payment too slowly, and because you didn't tell us you were posting our payment too slowly, that's a fraud, or that's a breach of contract. That allegation is repeated throughout the complaint, as are a handful of other core allegations that form the basis of the claims. And the problem with that is, if the term mortgage servicing in 560.2b means anything, it has to cover those kinds of back office loan accounting and financial operations acts of a thrift. If it doesn't cover that, then it's very difficult to understand what work that language is doing, Your Honor, in the regulation, because, of course, in every mortgage setting, there is an underlying mortgage note, and virtually every mortgage lawsuit alleges that whatever the servicer did wasn't authorized. The way the OTS seems to analyze that, Your Honor, is that affirmative undertakings, express voluntary contracts, like the 8%, 12% example I give, may well survive preemption. But on the other hand, these background implied gap-filling principles that work.
So take an allegation like 57 on page 11. Oakland routinely demands and collects recoverable breach fees from borrowers that are not authorized in borrowers and notes and mortgages.
Right.
Isn't that an allegation of a breach of contract?
Well, Your Honor, because it doesn't say it violates the contract. It says it's not authorized by the contract.
Oh, and here, please. Well, if something is not authorized by the contract and you try to collect it, then it's a breach of contract.
Your
that's
Honor,
absurd.
I don't want to push back on something that's absurd, Judge, but what I would say about that is when the OTS promulgates a regulation which says loan-related fees, including servicing fees, are preempted or protected by preemption, one wonders what they could have been talking about other than things like broker price opinion fees, breach fees,
etc. In the contract, you can have a fee schedule, you know, permitted by the OTS, but if the contract says X and then you bill them for Y, that's a breach of contract. You're trying to collect a contractual fee that wasn't contracted for.
Well, and the response we have on that is that the OTS regulation very clearly distinguishes between origination-related activities, like writing what's in the contract in the first place, and servicing activities, which happen later, after the contract is entered into. And the question would then be, why did the OTS see fit to impose a preemption on servicing separate from the preemption on origination, unless it understood that the way the industry works is, in a secondary market, there are servicers that service loans.
Well, you can't prove that. I mean, you can't get that out of the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not sure that's right. I mean, the complaint is long. It's Byzantine, but it's fairly clear when it says things like, what you did wrong was you didn't timely post payments.
No, but when they say you charged fees that weren't authorized in the contract, that sounds like and is consistent with an allegation of breach of contract. You're suggesting, no, really, these are fees for servicing that arise after the original contract. That's what you're saying. Can't dig that out of the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, here's the way we look at it. If you look at their timely posting allegations, which are core to their contract claims, ask yourself whether the state of California could pass a law requiring federal thrifts to post payments within 12 hours of receipt.
The issue is a simple breach of contract based on charging unauthorized fees. Now, you're saying the unauthorized fees are actually for servicing after the contract was signed. So it's for a new service being provided. That's your theory.
Well, we think that's clear from the complaint alleges that.
Out of the contract.
Your Honor, with respect, I don't think that's right. The contract alleges that Ocwen didn't originate the loans. It alleges that Ocwen received servicing of the loans after the loans were made. And, of course, the plaintiffs then named the case servicing litigation, which we think makes fairly clear that is their theory. Plainly, we can't tussle with the allegations of the complaint. That's accepted under Rule 12. But here, where they're cloaking in contract language conduct that fairly clearly couldn't be regulated if a state decided to pass a statute. The use of the word contract doesn't change the underlying nature of the claims here.
I don't know why unauthorized is not a suggestion of a breach.
Well, I think it is a suggestion of a breach. I think what it says
is... What more is necessary in a complaint?
Well, normally in a contract case, I think you'd expect that there would be allegations about what the contract provided.
Well, no.
Well, I mean,
you know about the pleading requirements of the federal rules.
Sure.
A short and plain statement. You don't have to list the terms of the contract. You just have to allege a breach of contract.
Well, most of the cases I've read, Your Honor, under Conley.
Look at the appendix to the federal rules of procedure on what satisfies the pleading requirements.
I understand, Your Honor. I mean, many
set forth the term that's been of the contract that's been violated. You just say you signed a contract, they promised to perform, and they didn't, and that's what you have to allege.
Well, I don't want to disagree with Your Honor on that point. Conley versus Gibson.
Disagree.
Respectfully, Your Honor.
Do you think there are special pleading requirements for a case of this sort?
No, I don't think there are special pleading requirements, but I do believe there's a body of case law under Conley versus Gibson, the seminal Rule 8 case, which say that the basic notice pleading standard in a contract case is to allege what the contract said. Here there's no allegation of that. There's no specificity or particularity requirement.
You don't need specificity or particularity.
Understood. But what much of the case law says under Conley is you have to, at a minimum, say what the contract required. Here there's nothing like that because the allegation is contract is background principles. Your Honor, if no further questions, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brooks. Mr. Klein?
May it please the Court. Gary Klein, Your Honor, from the law firm Roddy Klein and Ryan in Boston.
Same problem he did. I mean, this case doesn't belong here. You have a lot of allegations here which are clearly within the regulatory authority of OTS.
Your Honor, if I may, what I'd like to do is go to what I think is the hardest claim to support from a preemption perspective. Many of those claims, Your Honor, at the end of the complaint are state law claims that are in the case because individual plaintiffs brought them.
Whether they're in the case or out the case, they're preempted.
Your Honor, they're in virtually every instance, the claims at issue here are based on an underlying breach of contract. The claims that are based in a state law statutory provision are uniformly derivative of the claim that Ocwen breached the contract by claiming money is due that isn't due under the contract. So, for example, Your Honor, the fact that a late charge is being charged on a payment that was timely, which is one of the...
some good claims, but you have a lot. I mean, this New Mexico statute, what's that about? Unconscionable trade practices? What on earth does that mean?
Your Honor, we haven't reached the choice of law stage of the litigation at this point, Your Honor.
It didn't have to do with anything.
Well, the unfair...
Whether it's preempted by federal law, not whether New Mexico law applies or what. I don't understand you.
Your Honor, the underlying unfair trade practice claims in every instance are claims that Ocwen engaged in unfair or deceptive practices essentially by ignoring its contractual obligations.
With itemization of collection charges. Well, that's just the sort of thing that the OTS regulations govern. What kind of itemizations are required? That's preempted.
Your Honor, just if I could answer on that particular point, that particular allegation supports a claim under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And for that reason is not preempted.
There's violation of the Pennsylvania Consumer Protection Law. That's what I'm reading. 15th cause of action, violation of Pennsylvania Consumer Protection Law. That's where we have all this itemization stuff.
I would concede that if...
You don't know it's a complaint, apparently.
Excuse me?
You don't seem to know what you're charging and what you're not charging. If you think this was a federal charge...
Your Honor, the core complaint about failure to itemize or provide information is under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Hundreds of allegations, many of which seem clearly preempted.
Your Honor, our contention is that the claims that are included under any state statutory provision are included there solely because those state statutes provide remedies for the core breach of contract. And we believe that that's the teaching of the Supreme Court's holding in the recent Bates case, once you analyze the underlying factual analysis.
That's not what this allegation is. This allegation says that it's a violation of Pennsylvania law to fail to provide bars with itemization. That has nothing to do with remedies. That's a cause of action you're pleading.
My argument, Your Honor, is that on that point, that the federal law would control and that the state law just provides an additional remedy on something that's clearly actionable under federal law. To the extent that there's any...
Why is failure to itemize clearly actionable under federal law?
Because what happens in these cases, Your Honor, is that Ocwen places a lump sum charge on the account. A consumer, a homeowner who may not be particularly well educated, tries to get information about the amount due in order to verify whether the debt is accurate or not. The fact that Ocwen can't then tell people where that charge comes from is actionable as a debt collection violation, Your Honor. But for the purposes of this particular proceeding, certainly the pleading withstands meets the standards of notice pleading, as you pointed out earlier to Mr. Brooks.
Counsel, I heard you a moment ago start to make something that sounded like a concession.
I was going to concede that the claim under the Pennsylvania Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that goes to the enumeration of charges is probably preempted.
Okay, and as to the other statutory claims in the other state, without going through the complaint,
There is one set of more difficult issues from my perspective in looking at existing law and preemption, which go to Ocwen's use of something they call the Easy Pay system. The Easy Pay was a system that Ocwen used to encourage people to make their payments by telephone or by wire transfer. And one of the claims in the complaint is that they were not disclosing to people that there was a significant fee of $15 associated with using that payment mechanism. Our position on that particular issue is a little different from our position as to the balance of the claims, which we allege are not preempted because they're essentially contract-based claims. Our position on that Easy Pay system is that it's really not a core business that has anything to do with Ocwen as a federal savings bank, and that there's no preemption, no provision of the regulation that applies to that separate business, which is essentially just a business of making money in collecting money from homeowners, so that those charges essentially are entirely outside the preemptive effect of the regulation. And that's our position as to that particular claim, which I would acknowledge is a more difficult, more thorny preemption issue under federal law.
Yeah, I don't see how that's not servicing or falls within the rubric of servicing.
Your Honor, what we contend is that they set up this essentially what amounts to a separate business solely for the purpose of not to service the mortgages. There's dozens of other ways that people could make their payments, but solely to serve as an additional profit center. And by not disclosing to people the existence of those charges, what they're doing is has nothing to do with servicing. It has to do with collection that's outside their normal servicing business. There's no further questions, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Klein. Okay, well, thank you to both parties, both sides.